Welcome to the Pack Show with Dan Jackson.
Be careful who you ask, because they all know us.
This is your political, ag, and commentary show for the South Plains with special guest, a little humor, and opinion.
Loving on each other.
Well,
or,
you know,
lack thereof.
Our friend Miss Cortez, who is the gift that just keeps on giving to memes and stupid quotes.
Yes.
So sit back and enjoy the show.
And good morning, folks. Welcome to the Pack Show. We are streaming live today. We are not Facebook Live today, but kind of a special show for me. You'll notice the bump music is a little different. That is the bump music that my good friend Jim Stewart used every day on his radio show on KRFE AM 580. That was his intro music. You always knew it was time for the noon ag show or the 12:30 ag show with Jim and Tim Snyder when you heard that music. So we're going to have a special commentary today about Jim and kind of honor him at the top of the hour, his family and friends will gather in Lubbock to celebrate his life. And so thinking of them this morning especially, but again, my friend Jim is well and he's home. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Folks, got a lot to talk about today in the news. Lots of things going on. But I guess first I should welcome you. Welcome to the Pack Show. We're coming to you live from the downtown penthouse studios of Town Talk Radio and Adventure Marketing on the square in Brownfield, Texas, overlooking the beautiful Terry County Courthouse. And it is a pretty West Texas morning, folks. We are going to get warm, though. Checking in here with KCBD, 76 degrees right now. It is partly cloudy. The humidity is at 74%. And, folks, that humidity has been staying in there pretty good and would probably give us a chance of something stirring up maybe later this evening. Looking at the next few days. Today, again, headed for a high of 99 degrees. We've got a 5% chance of rain. Tomorrow, 99 again. Friday, we cool off just a little bit. Drops down to 89. We got a 15% chance of rain. And then Saturday, 95 for the high, 10% chance of rain. And then Sunday, 85 for the high with a 45% chance of moisture. They're talking in the afternoon and evening on that. Monday, we top out at 80 degrees with a 20% chance of rain. Tuesday, 85 with a 20% chance of rain. And then our rain chances kind of fall back off. But Wednesday, 98 degrees next week. And Thursday, 102, folks. So summer is making herself known. And then Friday, we'll wrap up the week at 101, it's saying, with a 5% chance of moisture. So, again, leave it to West Texas weather. It's going to be a little bipolar the next few days. But, again, got some rain in areas. I was in South Texas last week, worked my way up the coastal bend up into the El Campo area. Everywhere down there has a great crop. In fact, those guys from basically the valley up through the coastal bend actually need a little break. They need about 10 days of sunny, warm weather, let things kind of air out and dry out. It has been extremely rainy and wet down there, but they have a tremendous crop, got beautiful cotton and some really pretty milo and corn that's coming right along. We talked a little bit about that week before last. Looks really good. In fact, I'm headed back that way to begin the week next week. But anyway, beautiful country down there, but it was good to come home and see that it had rained here. Guys are wrapping up planting. Most of the irrigated has been planted across the high plains everywhere I've been this week thus far. Folks are wrapping up planting. We've got some pretty cotton starting to come up, starting to row really good in places. Again, dry land that hasn't been planted, they're wrapping up. The 5th of June is about the longest day on the calendar. It's kind of funny the way we work that, but leave it to USDA to pick a date. But anyway, it's all good. And it's looking good, folks. We're crossing our fingers for a good year. We're going to need some more rain. Hopefully we're going to get that the next few days, and hopefully going forward. So excited about that, looking at what's coming. Folks, again, got a great show today. Again, we're going to touch on the New World screwworm. That is the big topic in agriculture right now. That line had been held for 60 years, and it has now been breached. And so a lot of work going into to trying to get this under control and keep it from becoming an issue for our rancher friends. You've heard us talk a little bit about the Department of Labor and some of the actions they've taken against some of these folks who use H-2A. Secretary Rollins is hosting a ag roundtable concerning lawfare, and I've got a little bit about that. Then we're talking a little bit about Social Security. The data is not good. Congress had used that as their private piggy bank for years and bankrupted it. And I get a little offended even at our Republican friends who continue to call Medicare and Social Security an entitlement. That's not an entitlement. That's not anything they're giving us. We put that money in there on their promise to return it as part of keeping folks secure and able to live in their sunny years, or sunshine years, I guess you'd say. Finally, we'll wrap up a little bit. We're going to talk a little bit about New York's in the news again with some crazy legislation. Considering what you call your mom and dad is no longer mom and dad. And then the EU immigration, they have finally realized that President Trump was exactly right about opening the gates and just letting everybody in without doing any vetting and making sure people had decent intentions when they came. And then we'll talk a little bit, if we have time, about the Trump doctrine. And finally today, I've got a special commentary. Again, I was really blessed to get to know Jim Stewart and to be on his radio show a number of times, and it was always a great experience. Jim did that for 50 years in West Texas, and I called Jim the Dean of Ag Broadcasters very sincerely, and we lost him last Thursday. He had some health issues, and my good friend is well now, and he is at home. But we're going to talk a lot about Jim as we wrap up the show today. So, got lots to do, folks. I tell you what, we'll take our first set of commercial breaks. And when we come back, we'll start in with the latest in ag news. Hang tight, folks. We'll be back with more.
Life isn't easy. It's uphill, believe me. Whether you're weak or you're strong.
Town Life, Pogo Lambro has been the steady beat, connecting communities for over 70 years. In a world that's always evolving, your connection matters. That's why Pogo Lambro proudly provides fast, reliable internet services, reaching speeds of up to 1 gig on our fiber network. Whether you're running a business, staying connected with loved ones, or exploring the endless possibilities of online learning, Pogo Lambro is here to power your dreams with blazing fast internet. Your dreams, our connection. Pogo Lambro, connecting our communities for over 7 decades.
With power and versatility, the Kubota M7 tractor is built for hay and forage work. Up to 168 horsepower, superior loader lift capacity, easy-to-use controls, all-day comfort, and your choice of a 30x15 semi-power shift or Kubota variable transmission. And rated number one in durability and owner experience. Talk to your hometown Kubota dealer today to schedule a demo. Go to KubotaUSA.com for full disclaimer.
Come by your local Kubota dealer at Terry County Tractor, 1203 Seagraves Road in Brownfield, or 8504 Highway 87 in Lubbock.
Weather can be unpredictable, so it's important to be ready, come rain or shine. Luckily, Farmers Insurance has over 90 years of experience, so customers can prepare themselves when skies get rough. Contact Farmers agent Judy Bestler at 806-637-6461 to find out how she can help you protect the things that matter most to you. That's Judy Bestler at 806-637-6461.
We are Farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
Underwritten by Farmers, Truck, Fire, Insurance, Exchanges, and Affiliates. Products not available in every state.
Whether you're hauling tools and equipment to a job site or your family to a weekend getaway, count on the lineup of versatile, hardworking Ford trucks and vans to get the job done. Their rugged capability, outstanding performance, and legendary dependability earn them the label of Built Ford Tough. Find your Ford truck or van at Brownfield Ford, located at 1708 Lubbock Road in Brownfield, and go to www.brownfieldautomotive.com to check out their inventory.
Morning people wake up for peace and quiet. McDonald's breakfast people, we wake up for the sweet rush of getting that warm, delicious breakfast right before it ends.
McDonald's.
Be a McDonald's breakfast person and start your morning off with a $5.50 big breakfast with hotcakes, complete with a biscuit, sausage, scrambled eggs, and crispy hash browns, and pair it with a hot coffee. Order ahead in the app and pick up curbside. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Riding brim to brim from the ranch to the rodeo. Old Tommy done drawed him a wild one, a little bronc they call Smokey Joe. Smokey Joe ain't never been rode, and old Tommy ain't never been throwed. As he settled into the bucking chutes, he said, boys, here comes the show. It's about to get western around here tonight.
Well, indeed, it is about to get western. We've been talking about this for a while, and finally we have got our first reported cases of the new world screwworm across the border. It happened here just the last week or so. Texas Tribune had a story out yesterday. Out of Kerrville, three more cases of new world screwworm were confirmed in Texas by the U.S. Department of Agriculture on Monday, bringing the total number of cases to five. One new case is in Andrews County, nearly 400 miles north of Zavala County, where the first case was reported last week. The new cases are in different animals. In LaSalle County, about 80 miles southeast of Zavala, a calf has been infected. And in Andrews County, a veterinarian submitted the samples from an infested dog. According to the Andrews Veterinary Clinic, the case was seen on Saturday, and neither the dog nor its owner is local to Andrews. The Animal and Plant and Health Inspection Service, a USDA service, added the dog is from a household in Lee County, New Mexico, making it the state's first screwworm case. The APHIS said the dog's travel history and exposure history is unknown. The USDA is inspecting additional animals in the household and increases its outreach. Third case is a goat out of Gillespie County, about 170 miles north of Zavala County. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, along with Governor Greg Abbott, held a joint press conference in the Kipling Bushland U.S. Livestock Insects Research Laboratory. Man, that's a mouthful. In Kerrville, where they revealed their War on the Screwworm campaign with a slogan declaring inspect, report, and protect. Warning Texans, the situation is expected to get worse. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins said the U.S. Department of War is making the New World screwworm infestation one of its top priorities by putting a military commander in charge of helping accelerate resource gathering, construction, and research. South Texas ranchers are the front line in this battle against the screwworm, Rollins said, emphasizing the importance of reporting any screwworm incidents. Abbott also said the state's Emergency Command Center will be open 24/7 with specialists from Texas A&M and state personnel to ensure all incidents are reported and tracked. We have been beating this before and we'll do it again, Abbott told a room filled with reporters and ranchers. Rollins said there is currently no timeline in defeating the new world screwworm, but with the partnerships between federal, state, and local officials, it shouldn't take multiple years like it has in the past. Some would say it's impossible, but this is Texas, Rollins said. The screwworm is a parasitic fly that infests living mammals, especially cattle. State and federal officials are racing to contain the insect that has been on a northern migration track since at least 2023. Agriculture leaders fear if the fly is not contained, it could cost the state's cattle economy at least $1.8 billion. Dudley Hoskins, Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs with the USDA, urged animal owners to stay vigilant. Check their animals closely and report anything that looks suspicious. We need a partnership of animal owners across the region, Hoskins said in a statement. Together, we can protect our livestock, our communities, and the health of our animals nationwide. Rollins called out recent comments made by Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller alleging producers and ranchers won't report screwworm findings out of fear of being quarantined, harmful to their efforts. Unserious comments from an unserious AG commissioner who only has a few months left, she said. Wow. Nice little shot over the bow there. The USDA is also exploring alternative options to combat the screwworm, including putting ivermectin in animal feed. Rollins announced Monday that President Donald Trump appointed John Bellinger, a member of the Texas A&M University Board of Regents, to be the new senior advisor for the new world screwworm preparedness. Bellinger is expected to help explore all available technologies to combat the screwworm. Bellinger was appointed to the A&M board in 2023, where he serves as chair of the Committee on Research. So they are putting people in place to get this thing contained. I have heard ivermectin talked about. I had a conversation with a good friend of mine day before yesterday, actually, who said that that ivermectin might be a tool that they could pull out of the toolbox to use for this. This thing is very dangerous. I read the story about the two gentlemen who came up with the sterile fly answer 60 years ago, folks. It's been 60 years since we've had to deal with this screw worm. These two gentlemen, it was trial and error. It was definitely the old days. They used radiation to basically sterilize male flies. So when the females, when there's no breeding involved, the eggs they lay are obviously not fertilized, so they won't, aren't going to matter. It very interesting story about how they worked to figure this all out and get it done. And hopefully, one of the centers we were using was woefully inadequate. Hopefully, they're reinforcing that. And I hope with the technology that we have available today, compared to what those two gentlemen did 60 years ago, that we can get a handle on this and get things under control very quickly. It is definitely a national security problem, and I appreciate the president seeing it that way, because as we talk about on this show a lot, sorry, folks, agriculture, production agriculture in particular, is vital to this nation's security. Our farmers and ranchers, our food and fiber supply is key to our survival. And again, I appreciate the president looking at it that way. One of the other things, and we've talked about this on the show, there's been an effort by Department of Labor in particular to come after the agriculture community. In a lot of cases on matters that are very minor, they have blown up, and it has turned into huge fines, $500,000 in one case, over $1 million in another. It has been very, very interesting to see how this has all developed. And so I've got this, and I'm going to play it. This is testimony from a rancher. It's not insanely long. Let's see if I can get it to start over here, folks. All right, folks, I'm going to play this for you real quick. Hang tight.
Understand this war, we must ask who, how, and why. It is structured from the top down, being waged by a network of global elites who seek to control any and all means of production and natural resources. It is carried out through the infiltration of federal, state, and local governments, universities, corporations, and even agricultural trade organizations. Using conservation incentives and public-private partnerships, it reshapes the culture and restricts private property. Because the goal is to replace private ownership with centralized control of the major means of production and natural resources. Climate change is used as the crisis. Sustainability is offered as the solution. But the result is production and consumption control and the total loss of personal and productive liberty. Understand this war, we must ask.
This is again a rancher that was testifying, but his small part here is basically calling out what's been going on in the country. And again, we've talked about it pretty extensively on the show, having to do with three different sets of folks who have been come after on the labor side for things they didn't do wrong. They simply ran out of work. Their employees did not want to stay. They were going to fulfill the contract. The employees didn't want to stay. They wanted to go home if there's no work to do. And so they made the arrangements and did everything they were supposed to, got them home, paid them what they owed them. And DOL pulls you into their system. Well, you're basically the tribunal that you go in front of is DOL employees. Ex-DOL and lawyers are the judiciary side of it, of their own little courtroom. And it has been very expensive. Now, there's a Supreme Court case that has been fought on this, but that's just one of the examples. And so, again, another one of those things that we need to be aware of. Things are rapidly changing in this country, and the respect for agriculture is one of those things that we seem to be losing. It kind of blows me away when we depend so much on our farmers and ranchers. And, again, you know, we talk about it a lot. We spend less for our food and fiber than anybody in the world, and that's, you know, people are, you know, talking about inflation and things like that. And don't get me wrong, I understand absolutely, but the problem is we're still, even with the inflation and everything else, we are still paying less for our food and fiber than anybody in the world. The next thing I wanted to hit on, this story came through Fox News. Social Security has less than 10 years before reserves are exhausted, a new report warns. The clock is ticking faster for American workers and seniors. The Social Security Administration's newly released 2026 Trustees Report confirms that the federal retirement safety net is less than 7 years away from physical depletion, as the Old Age and Survivors Insurance, OASI, trust fund will completely exhaust its accumulated reserves in the fourth quarter of 2032. Once the reserve dries up, ongoing tax revenues will cover only 78% of scheduled retirement benefits, according to the report. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, enacted on July 4, 2025, this law makes permanent the lower income tax rates and adjusted tax brackets originally enacted under the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and both increases and makes permanent the larger standard deduction of the 2017 Act, the report says. The OBBBBA also adds a temporary additional standard deduction for taxpayers over 65. As a result, less income tax will be paid on Social Security benefits. Well, they never should have been paying taxes on their Social Security benefits. They put that money back and were told it was going to be there, and Congress rated that as their own little piggy bank, and we are now seeing the results of that. That's just my take on this, folks. And the OASI and the DI trust funds will receive lower levels of revenue in the future from income taxation of Social Security benefits. No duh. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, CBO, previously warned about the fund's insolvency date, explaining that because the government would not have the legal authority to make payments in excess of receipts, it would no longer be able to pay the full amount scheduled or projected under current law. Social Security benefits are funded by payroll tax receipts, along with the OASI trust fund. Once that trust fund is tapped out, the federal government would only be able to pay benefits equal to incoming payroll tax revenue under current law, meaning benefits would face cuts without action by Congress. In an interview on the Moon Griffin Show Monday, House Speaker Mike Johnson, Louisiana, said, "The reason we're in trouble is because over 74% of federal spending is on autopilot, mandatory spending. That is your entitlement programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and things like Social Security. They have to be adjusted and fixed." Now, I'm going to stop here just a second because I disagree with Speaker Johnson. Now, Medicaid, yes, it is an entitlement program, but Medicare and Social Security are not. We were made a promise back in the 1930s that if we put into this, it would be there when we retired, and I am deeply offended when they call that entitlement spending. It's not welfare, folks. We put money into that. They take it out of our check without our consent every week, every month, however you're paid, and then because Congress decided that was a great little fund to tap into, they depleted it, and they created this problem. This isn't anything to do with John Q. Public. This is our Congress in action. And so I'm a little offended at Speaker Johnson falling into that trap. Now, I go on. We have a plan to do that next year, and it's critical because we're at a $40 trillion plus in debt. At some point, you've got to get in a hole so deep that you can't climb out of it. So desperate times call for desperate measures, Johnson said. The Social Security Administration's latest trustees report suggests that if Congress alters the law to allow funding sharing between the retirement and healthier disability insurance system, the total depletion window can be extended to the third quarter of 2034. Following a combined depletion in 2034, 83% of scheduled benefits will be funded by ongoing payroll collections. The trustees recommend that lawyers address the projected trust fund shortfalls in a timely way to phase in necessary changes gradually and give workers and beneficiaries time to adjust, says the report. Implementing changes sooner rather than later would allow more generations to share in the needed revenue increases and reductions in scheduled benefits. Pardon me. Again, our government doing what it does best. They screwed it up, and now we're going to have to pay to fix it, apparently. We'll see how that all goes, but again, another one of those things to watch as we go forward. I want to wrap up as we head into the top of the hour this morning. New York is doing some really crazy things. We've got Mondami as mayor, and apparently folks are rapidly realizing that was a mistake. That should have never been done. And now we see that things are in trouble. And so I'm kind of anxious to see how this all works as we go forward. It has been very interesting to see Mondami's reign. But this actually comes out of the state of California, and it is a little concerning to me because they, again, continue to do this kind of stuff. Bill replacing mother and father with gender-neutral terms passes in New York and heads to Governor Hochul's desk. New York Democrats recently passed a bill that would remove the words mother and father from parts of state law, sending the legislation to Governor Kathy Hochul's desk for final approval. Under the new bill targeting state child custody and parental laws, mother becomes a gestating parent, father becomes a non-gestating parent, and paternity becomes parentage. It passed the state Senate this week after progressing through the assembly in March. Democrats who drafted the legislation claim the wording shift would promote inclusivity, while critics claim the change is unnecessary, with the legislative session having ended for the year on Thursday. Hochul said during a news conference that she isn't familiar with the proposal, but promised to review it. I have until the end of the year to review them and make a decision, so I won't be commenting pending legislation, Hochul said. Republican gubernatorial candidate Bruce Blackman shared multiple posts responding to the bill on Facebook, Friday. And Kathy Hochul's New York mom is now defined as a gestating parent, Blakeman wrote. Not when I'm a governor. I'll stand up for moms and dads against this insanity. This bill is a continuation of Hochul's war on families, and I won't stop fighting until we take New York back, he added. Representative Claudia Tenney, she's a Republican from New York, reacted to the bill on X Thursday, saying the party that can't define a woman is now rewriting New York law to erase mothers and fathers. Only in Albany could mom and dad become too controversial. I tend to agree. New York has a gift for this kind of stuff. I'll tell you what, folks, we're gonna take our next set of commercial breaks. And when we come back, we're gonna talk a little bit about EU immigration and President Trump's doctrine as it relates to Iran. Be very interesting to see how that all goes on. We had another incident yesterday, and we reciprocated, so we'll see how this all ends up going. But I tell you what, folks, hang tight, and we'll be back with more of the PAC Show.
West Texas weather is famous for being unpredictable. A sudden, violent storm can knock out electric service without warning at any time. Lintigar Electric Cooperative stays prepared 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to take care of any emergency and to restore service as soon as possible. West Texas weather may be unpredictable, but you can be certain about Lintigar Electric Cooperative's readiness to serve you quickly and efficiently. Lintigar Electric Cooperative, owned and operated by those we serve.
At Sundown State Bank, there's nothing more important than people we serve. Dedicated to community development and involvement, our roots are in Texas, and we're proud of it. With 5 branches across West Texas in Brownfield, Denver City, Leveland, Sundown, and Wall, we are positioned to serve rural communities with excellent rates, personalized service, and trustworthy banking. Explore our banking services at sundownsb.com. Sundown State Bank, your choice for local banking.
Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Terry County Veterinary Hospital is your first stop for your animals' well-being. Dr. Jim Ridenour and staff are committed to keeping your pets and animals healthy and happy. Terry County Vet provides quality medical care for all animals, large and small. We want to make sure your pets, livestock, or show projects are taken care of. Whether it be through maintenance or emergencies, Terry County Vet Hospital is there for you and your animal. Call 806-585-6363 to set up an appointment or stop by their location on the Lubbock Highway between Brownfield and Meadow.
State Farm Insurance in Brownfield has a new agent, Jenny Coor. Jenny has decades of experience with State Farm Insurance in La Mesa and is ready to serve the Brownfield community. Visit her at 201 East Hill Street in Brownfield or go online to jennycoor.com or call 806-637-9200 to let Jenny help you customize a coverage plan that protects what's important to you, your family, your belongings, and your finances. Jenny Coor can assist you in creating a solution that's tailored to your needs with options such as safe driving rewards, bundling, and discounts.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Experience ultimate comfort with BNS Heating and Air Conditioning, where you can always count on us for fast service that keeps you cozy year-round. We make upgrading your system easy and affordable with free estimates, flexible financing options, and cutting-edge energy-efficient Trane products that deliver long-term savings. If you want to cut through all the BS, call 80-663-60050 or visit www.bnsheatingandair.com now to secure your appointment and take the first step towards a more comfortable home.
We're back with the PAC show today. Again, streaming live. Don't look for us on Facebook. I don't know if Eric broke the camera or I did, but apparently we don't have a camera. So, anyway. Hey, folks, good to have you back. One other thing that I wanted to touch on, and this has been a hot topic, obviously for a lot of reasons, ever since it happened. Yesterday, Carmelo Anthony was found guilty of murder in Texas, or in the Texas track meet stabbing. A Collin County jury has sentenced Carmelo Anthony to 35 years in prison after he was found guilty of murder in the fatal stabbing of 17-year-old Memorial High School student Austin Metcalf during a track meet at Frisco. Anthony faced up to life in prison after being convicted of murder. He will be eligible for parole after serving half that time. He broke down in tears and was shaking as the verdict was read Tuesday afternoon, and he was immediately taken into custody. Following Anthony's sentencing, the court heard from Metcalf's loved ones who had prepared victim impact statements. Metcalf's father, Jeff, screamed at Anthony. Court officers approached him but allowed him to finish. "We were robbed," he yelled at Anthony, telling him not to look down. "The public response sickens me, especially when a gag order doesn't allow me to defend my son," Metcalf said. "This was never about race or politics, but what you did was you chose to make it about both. We all bleed the same color. You are free to make choices all of your life, but not free to face the consequences. They weren't bullies, and they weren't racist. You failed your parents, you failed yourself, and you failed society," he added. "You don't belong. I forgive you, but I do not forgive what you did. You can't even look me in the eye, but you can stab my son in the heart," he said, before staring at Anthony as he walked back to his seat. Hunter Metcalf, Austin's twin brother, was in the courtroom for the first time and read a victim impact statement. "I just want some respect if you could look me in the eye," he said to Anthony, who looked up at him. "I want you to realize how much pain you caused me and my family," he said. "You let the devil take over you in the moment. Now I want everything taken from you," he said, according to Fox 4. "You took everything from me. I woke up every morning and his door is still shut." A montage of pictures of Austin and Hunter growing up played on the screen. Austin's mother, Megan, said all she has left of Austin is videos. She described how she packed her son a snack before the track meet and sent him off, not realizing it would be the last time she ever saw him, according to Fox 4. "You may have been sentenced to 35 years behind bars. You should feel lucky," she told Anthony. "I've been sentenced to a lifetime without my son." Anthony's parents were not in the room for the sentencing or victim statements. Before he was sentenced, his mother pleaded for mercy. "Please have mercy on my son," Kayla Hayes said, as mascara stains could be seen streaking her tear-soaked cheeks. "He's my oldest, my firstborn, my baby. I love him so very much," she said. When asked by Anthony's defense team if her son regretted his actions, Hayes replied, "Yes, he's very sorry for what he did." Jurors were then tasked with determining Anthony's sentence, which they decided Metcalf's stabbing was not in sudden passion, which would have capped his potential prison time at 20 years behind bars. He ultimately faced the possibility of spending the rest of his life in prison. "This verdict sends a clear message. Violence like this won't be tolerated in our Collin County community, and we remain committed to protecting our school and standing with victims and their families," Collin County District Attorney Greg Willis said at a news conference Tuesday evening. The verdict followed days of emotional testimony from student-athletes, police officers, forensic experts, and coaches who described the confrontation that ended with Metcalf's death at Kirkendall Stadium on April 2nd, 2025. The verdict was reached in just 3 hours after jurors were sent to deliberate following closing arguments on Tuesday. Anthony, who was 17 at the time, admitted he stabbed Metcalf but claimed he acted in self-defense. As the verdict was being read, more than 100 protesters split between supporters of Metcalf and Anthony, descended on the courthouse, and at least one protester was taken into custody after a fight broke out in response to the guilty verdict. There was a heavy police presence outside the courthouse. A court official said a few arrests were made, but no other details were immediately available. What happened at the track meet? At the center of the case was a confrontation that unfolded beneath the Memorial High School team tent during a rainy track meet attended by both schools from across North Texas. According to trial testimony, Anthony, a student from a different school, sat beneath the Memorial tent shortly before the confrontation began. Several student athletes testified that they questioned why he was there and repeatedly asked him to leave. Witnesses told jurors that Austin Metcalf eventually approached Anthony and asked him to move. One student testified that Anthony was asked to leave roughly 15 times. Multiple witnesses recalled Anthony responding with statements such as, "Touch me and you'll find out. If you want me to move, you'll have to move me." Several students testified Anthony became increasingly aggressive as the exchange continued. One witness told jurors it appeared Anthony was provoking Metcalf, while another testified it looked like Anthony was looking for a fight. Multiple witnesses said they did not believe Metcalf wanted to fight, with one recalling Metcalf saying, "I'm not going to fight you at a track meet." Witnesses also repeatedly referenced Anthony's keeping one hand inside his backpack during the exchange. Several students testified they believed Anthony was bluffing when he suggested he had something in the bag. The confrontation turned physical moments later. Witnesses gave differing accounts about exactly how Metcalf touched Anthony before the stabbing, and some describing a shove and others describing a grab. Testimony also varied on whether Metcalf used one hand or two. It really doesn't matter. I'm still stunned at the people that are protesting this. Anthony then stabbed Metcalf in the chest, according to testimony. Several students said they initially believed Anthony was bluffing. One witness testified that he didn't realize Metcalf had been stabbed until he saw Anthony throw an object into the bleachers. Another recalled hearing Metcalf say, "Oh my God." Prosecutors argued that Anthony escalated a verbal disagreement into a deadly encounter by pulling a knife from his backpack and stabbing an unarmed teenager. To support that argument, prosecutors called 21 witnesses, including students who witnessed the confrontation, investigators who processed the crime scene, and medical examiner who performed the Metcalf's autopsy. Several student witnesses testified that Anthony was the aggressor and that the stabbing didn't appear to be out of an act of self-defense. One witness testified that no one attempted to gang up on Anthony and described the physical contact before the stabbing as very minor, pushing at most. Another witness testified that Anthony appeared to be looking for a fight. That seems to be the common theme here. Jurors also heard testimony that Anthony told an officer after the stabbing, "I'm not alleged, I did it. He put his hands on me, I told him not to." The medical examiner's testimony was among the most difficult moments of the trial. Metcalf's family left the courtroom while the autopsy photographs were shown to the jury and his injuries were described in detail. The defense's case. Defense attorneys argued that Anthony acted in self-defense after being confronted by a larger student and physically touched during the dispute. Throughout the trial, defense attorneys emphasized that Anthony was seated for most of the confrontation while Metcalf and other students were standing nearby. Testimony indicated that Metcalf outweighed Anthony by roughly 50 to 60 pounds. Defense attorneys also highlighted the inconsistencies among witnesses' accounts regarding where students were positioned and how many hands Metcalf used when touching Anthony and who was standing nearby at the time of the confrontation. Anthony's track coach testified that athletes from different schools routinely mingle at track meets, and his team lacked enough volunteers to set up a tent that day. He acknowledged, however, that students should leave if asked to leave another team's tent. Wow. One of Anthony's friends testified that he had previously spent time under tents belonging to other schools without the issue, but said he would leave if asked. Defense witnesses also pointed to testimony that another student under the tent knew Anthony and greeted him when he arrived. After the prosecution rested its case, defense attorneys moved for a directed verdict, arguing prosecutors had failed to prove their case. The judge denied the motion. The trial frequently shifted from legal arguments to raw emotion. Several teenage witnesses became emotional while recounting the events and testified while holding a football because it helped calm his nerves. One testified while holding a football because it calmed his nerves. Another gripped a yellow stress ball throughout his testimony. That witness, a football player and track athlete, told jurors that his father had recently been murdered in California. He described Metcalf as a football captain and mentor who believed in him. A recent Liberty High School graduate became emotional while recalling seeing Metcalf bleeding after the stabbing. Witnesses repeatedly described Metcalf as a leader, teammate, and role model. One student testified that Metcalf was always leading and always protecting us. Another recalled Metcalf telling Anthony, "I'm not going to fight you at a track meet." The trial also brought renewed attention to the devastation suffered by the Metcalf family. Austin's twin brother Hunter witnessed the stabbing and was with Austin in his final moments. Austin Metcalf's father, Jeff Metcalf, has repeatedly spoken publicly about losing his son. "Austin was the light of my life," he told Fox News. Metcalf said his son died in Hunter's arms. "This person made a bad choice and affected both his family and my family forever." Despite the tragedy, Metcalf publicly expressed forgiveness toward Anthony. "People ask me, how can you forgive this other person?" Metcalf told Fox News. "I forgive the other person because forgiveness is not for him. The forgiveness is for me so I can have peace. His life is destroyed and my life is destroyed as well." The case drew national attention for the months leading up to the trial, fueled by public debate over Anthony's self-defense claim, questions surrounding race, and demonstrations organized by supporters of both families. The attention surrounding the case extended beyond the courtroom and often played out outside the Collin County Courthouse. I'm going to stop there because I'm just telling you folks, this has nothing to do with race. It has nothing to do with anything other than the fact that this young man made a really bad decision that day and decided to stab a kid. That's what this boils down to. This isn't about race. He was asked repeatedly to leave, which is not uncommon. If you're not on that team, they didn't want you under their tent. That's understandable, completely understandable. And instead of calmly getting up and walking out, he decided he was baiting everybody for a fight. And that's what happened. And unfortunately, he decided to make a devastating decision. And again, I pray for both those families. But these idiots that were standing out there yesterday protesting this verdict, he took another young man's life with a knife. With a knife. He made the decision to stab. Could have got up and walked away. The race baiters are out in full force. They're going to try to turn this into something that it shouldn't be. It's a very horrid situation for both families, and I pray for both of them. But that young man made a decision, and now he's going to pay. He's going to pay for it. He's justice has been served. He's going to do his time, and that's the way that goes. You make that decision, you're going to live with the consequences, folks. I want to move on. The EU has always kind of looked down their nose at the U.S. We've saved them over our history multiple times, but they continue to look down on us. But finally, Europe is realizing. It says, "You're destroying your countries." Is Europe finally heeding Trump's warning on illegal immigration? Earlier in June, the European Union appeared to finally react to concerns raised by President Donald Trump and many European voters over illegal immigration by introducing tougher border entry rules for the 27-nation bloc. The EU agreed on new, stricter rules regarding migration and asylum. Laws are specifically designed to ensure that illegal undocumented immigrants who enter the bloc are processed and, when necessary, quickly sent to deportation centers in countries outside the EU. People seeking asylum will be screened for identity, security, and their health before even entering any asylum system. The border officials will now track and record non-EU citizens entering and exiting the bloc. Plus, it will use biometric data such as fingerprints and facial recognition, and all member states must now help one another and share information. The Associated Press reported that the provincial deal struck by the EU's three main institutions is expected to go to EU lawmakers and governments where approval is expected. Alan Mendoza, founder and executive director of the Henry Jackson Society, told Fox News Digital, "The EU's demography is changing Europe's culture. We are now having to deal with people who are not integrating with the local customs. While the UK is not part of the EU," he said, "Britain's efforts are behind the new EU rules," noting that the country has not managed to have offshore migrant holding centers, which would make Britain not seen as such a soft touch. Other experts say the longer countries take to fix the problem, the harder it will be to deal with. Some say it's already too late. I would say for France and England both, it is way, way too late. We've seen some riots in Ireland over the last few days over a Somali immigrant stabbing and cutting an eye out of an English or Irishman. It's going to get ugly, folks. These folks are not Western. They are not going to convert to Western customs. And the quicker we realize that, the better off we're all going to be. If they don't like our countries, then they need to leave and go back to theirs. Other while Europe's workaday men and women have clearly seen the problems of illegal immigration for years, their leaders are only just getting the message. President Trump told the world leaders about damage caused by a flood of undocumented migrants into Europe during his speech at the United Nations General Assembly last year. "You're destroying your countries," he said. "Europe is in serious trouble. They've all been invaded by a force of illegal aliens like nobody's ever seen before." Just last week, Vice President J.D. Vance commented on the stabbing death of an 18-year-old British man who was stabbed to death. In part, Vance posted, "Henry Nowak died the same way civilization dies, abandoned, handcuffed by authorities who neither trusted nor cared for him, and accused of hate crimes he did not commit. His murder is tragic, as it is enraging. He should still be alive today and would be if the last few generations of European elites had stood their ground against the policies of self-hatred and the mass invasion of migrants, many of whom despise the West and the people who love it. Again, if you don't like our countries, then don't come. I mean, it ain't rocket science." Secretary of War Pete Hegseth also made a reference to the topic during a speech to commemorate D-Day in France over the weekend. "Sadly today, different European beaches are stormed by different dangerous ideologies. Beaches in Spain and Italy and Greece and Bulgaria, boats with men arrive. When will European capitals do something about that invasion, or is it too late? I pray not, and I believe not," he said. Elsewhere in the EU, Spain seems to have broken with the rest of the bloc. On its new stance on undocumented immigration, the country has decided to legalize 500,000 undocumented immigrants. When undocumented immigrants arrive, they get papers and they get Social Security. Xavier Negre, an owner of La Derecho Diario, a newspaper, told Fox News Digital. He says a lot of the push to house migrants has come via non-governmental organizations. NGOs had big business, and they promoted illegal immigration, he says. Another problem is that many undocumented immigrants don't choose to integrate into their new domicile. They don't have the same values, he said. We import a lot of people, and some realize they can steal iPhones and wallets, he said, commenting on the rise in crimes. Critics of the move mostly came from European left and NGOs. Melissa Camarera from the French Green Party said the deal was a historic setback for human rights in the bloc. "No, ma'am, it's protecting your way of life." The legalization of return hubs outside Europe, the European Union, the green light for the detention of minors, home visits inspired by ICE practices, the legal arsenal now serving a xenophobic ideology is now complete, she said. Yeah, these folks aren't going to realize it till they're having to wear hijabs, and they can no longer do what they want to do. But sometimes you've got to let people get hit by the hammer. I don't know. It's a pretty sad deal. Lots going on in the world, and I want to touch on one more thing here before we wrap up today. President Trump, I get kind of irritated at people. They want to throw rocks at everything he's done, yet what he's done has been to benefit the country. What he's done is shored up our safety, shored up our finances, and we are dealing with a little bit of issue over the Iran war and fuel prices. But again, I think that's going to be remedied in short order. This is what was kind of interesting. This story hit June 7th, and I read it and was kind of stunned. Iran admits extraordinary new detail in Khomeini strike. Trump offered a way out. New details from Iran's top diplomat about the strike that killed Supreme Leader Ali Khomeini provided some of the clearest evidence yet of the precision and strategy behind the joint U.S.-Israeli operation that launched Operation Epic Fury, a counterterrorism expert said Sunday. The account revealed by Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi in a new television interview also highlights what analysts describe as a defining feature of President Donald Trump's national security doctrine. Using a decapitation strike against a hostile regime, while simultaneously creating an off-ramp to end the conflict. Well, the building we were sitting in was targeted, but the wing we were in remained intact while the other wing of the building was destroyed, Araghchi said in an interview that aired June 4th on the Lebanon-based Hezbollah-backed Al-Mayadeen television network. While Araghchi survived the February 28th strike because he was in a different wing of Khomeini's compound when the attack occurred, he went on to detail how Khomeini was in his office and how others survived. Reviewing the original segment, counterterrorism expert Dr. Omar Mohammed told Fox News Digital that Araghchi's account confirms the operation targeted a specific section of the complex rather than flattening the entire site. In the Arabic version, Arachi says he was in a different wing of the compound briefing another official, and his wing survived while the leader's office was destroyed, Mohammed explained. Arachi also told the interview that he had an appointment that day with an official at the compound regarding the Geneva negotiations, and that based on the usual workflow, Khomeini had been present, had to be present in his office. Mohammed, the director of anti-Semitism research initiative at the program on extremism at George Washington University, added that if Arachi's account is accurate, this was Iran declaring glaringly acknowledging the U.S. Strategic capabilities. They did not flatten a building. They took one wing and left one the one next to it standing. That is President Trump's whole doctrine in a single strike. He doesn't want a war of occupation. He wants to show the United States can reach the center of a hostile regime with precision and then offer a way out, Mohammed said. The daylight strike on the Elder Khomeini's compound was carried out by Israeli jets targeting the site with 30 precision munitions alongside Sparrow air-launched ballistic missiles. Military officials confirmed that the precise strike sequence killed Khomeini 86 alongside Defense Minister Amir Nasrallah, IRGC Commander Mohammed Pakpour, and multiple top security leaders. Trump confirmed U.S. involvement in Khomeini's killing in a post on social media at the time. He was unable to avoid our intelligence and highly sophisticated tracking systems, and working closely with Israel, there was not a thing he or the other leaders killed alongside him can do, the president wrote. Iran was handed the clearest message an adversary can get. We can reach out your reach. We can reach your leader in his own office, and here's the off-ramp, Mohammed noted. A rational state takes the exit. Tehran did the opposite. It fired on Israel, killed a civilian in Bahrain, struck Kuwait, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates, and closed the Strait of Hormuz, setting off a global energy crisis. The surgical strike was American. The months-long war that followed was Iran's choice. Following the leadership transition, Ali Khomeini's son, Mojtaba Khomeini, became Iran's new supreme leader. He has since been involved in a back-channel discussion with the U.S., while maintaining a confrontational public stance. In Arabic, Arachi calls the new leader the young Khomeini in place of the elderly Khomeini. That is the language of the monarchy, not the republic of clerics, Mohammed observed. They are rewriting theology on air to fit a son who lacks the religious rank, who was wounded in the same strike and then vanished for weeks. A revolution that came to power by ending a monarchy is handing the throne from father to son. The real story is not that Iran is strong, Mohammed continued. It has shown the precision of American firepower, and the door was held open, and it chose to widen the war anyway. Again, very interesting to see how President Trump has worked this and how it has worked to send a message, and I think to a lot of folks, not just Iran, about what we are capable of and what we will do if we are pushed. Well, folks, we've reached that point in the show, and, it's been kind of a rough week, and I've got a commentary here that I put together because, it's not very often that you get to be friends with and acquainted with a legend, and I've gotten to know several folks that I would call a legend over my lifetime because of God's good grace and the opportunities that he places before us. But this one was tough. Since 2005, that tune has signaled the beginning of the Noon Ag Show on AM 580 on KRFE. And sadly, it has all changed. And Jim has been retired for a few years. Tim and Wade Wilkes have continued that show. It's the Texas Oil, Ag, and Gas Show now. But hearing this tune always let me know that my good friend Jim was fixing to take the air. And sometimes I got to be with him. He was kind enough to ask me to sit in and come in at times. But I want to get to my commentary. Last Thursday at 3:20 in the afternoon, I was headed home after a full 4 days of traveling from West Laco up to El Campo for safety seminars. Tim Snyder texted and let me know that Jim Stewart had passed away. Immediately, I thought of his wife, Doris, and his family, and I prayed for their peace. And in that moment, I thought, we've lost an icon in West Texas radio. I called Jim the Dean of Ag Broadcasters, and he was. His 50 years on air are a history of West Texas agriculture, from the farm strike in the mid-70s and his 10 days of reporting from Washington, D.C., keeping us up to date with the latest from seed breeders, folks at AgriLife, the latest technology to help our producers stay efficient in all they do, to the politics of the day, and a visit by most every candidate for everything from county commissioner to Congress. They all knew to stop by Jim's show because it was a must. He let folks know about 4-H and FFA events, even covering the state FFA convention. He also did what no other broadcast journalist has ever done, to my knowledge. Jim interviewed 6 sitting United States presidents. Unheard of. He reminisced one time about interviewing George H.W. Bush during his campaign in Lubbock. Well, later on, after President Bush was elected, he came to the Ag Broadcasters Conference in Kansas City. Well, Jim was in the group that afternoon, and President Bush had made some prepared remarks, and then he looked out to take questions. Now, Jim was in the group and was sitting there when George H.W. Bush looked out after taking a few questions and said, "Hey, Jim, how are things in Lubbock?" Jim said everyone instantly turned and looked at him like, "You know the president?" He said that was a fun day. Jim made everybody feel at home. His easygoing demeanor and that smile. You were there for a visit, not an interview, a visit. When I was offered the opportunity to do the PAC show, I stopped in one day when he was wrapping up his show. He asked what I was doing, and I said, "I need some advice." And I asked, "What advice would you offer a rookie?" He said just 2 things. 1, never do an interview. Just visit with folks, and you'll find out what you need to know. 2, never ambush anyone because you'll never get them back on. Well, I've adhered to that advice, and it has served me very well. But I guess I've gotten ahead of myself. Jim led a life worthy of a movie. He served in the United States Army in Vietnam. He was a Lubbock police officer. And during his PD days, he was a bodyguard for Elvis on both of his visits to Lubbock, and for Tom Jones when he made a stop in the Hub City as well. He reminisced about eating breakfast each morning with Elvis's dad, Vernon, and then they would go up to Elvis's room and visit with Elvis and his girlfriend. He said Elvis was just a good old boy, always respectful and always nice. When I asked about Tom Jones, he said, "Well, that one was pretty wild," and he left it at that. Jim, then at the behest of a friend, did a brief stint on TV and was asked to fill in for a new ag broadcaster who was supposedly on the way but apparently never showed. But Jim's true calling was radio, and that's where I got to know Jim, really grow up with him. My dad kept a Montgomery Ward radio on top of our refrigerator. It was kind of ahead of its time. It had 2 separate speakers, and it had a timer on it. Each morning at 5 a.m., it came to life, and it was set on KFYO, AM 790. Big Ed was at the helm of the show with Max Mott doing the news, and Jim covered ag. Then at noon, especially during the summer when I was out of school, we'd go home, make a sandwich, and we'd tune in for the ag show and listen to the latest news and markets from Jim. After years with KFYO, they changed formats, and Jim took a little break, but then he came back to KRFE, AM 580, and 2005 and began a new ag show. And I really got to know Jim when I moved to Meadow in 2002. I ran into him at his booth at the Gin Show, and I would say that was circa 05-06, and he invited me to sit in that day. And from there, he'd periodically call, and I'd run by or call in. It was always fun. Jim and Tim Snyder, well, that was a match made in heaven. And then you add in Dan Seal, and well, that was quite a crew. They all 3 had fun, and we were all along for the ride. My friend Jim was a great fan of Texas Tech, and he was the original Tech tailgater. Jim really enjoyed his partnership with Red Raider Meats and what that program did for the kids. He was also a huge supporter of the Girls and Boys Ranch, from stepping in for Santa when called for to helping with fundraisers. Jim did it all. He also loved the Coyote Store down at Gale and was a part of that family as well. He had a table each weekend for the concerts and held court there. For many years, he and Dan Seal would pick up all the steaks that they cooked for the concerts on Saturday evening for the Coyote Store. Like I said, Jim did it all. I guess you can tell what made Jim special was his love of people, and especially young people. I was proud to be there the day his granddaughter Brooke came on the show with him. He had a smile that day a mile wide. I also got to be there when Texas Country Reporter came to town and did a story on him. Tim Snyder had worked very hard with the folks at TCR to get them there, and it was a great day. Jim, as always that day, ended that interview by saying, quite simply, he was blessed. I think those of us who listened to Jim, though, we were the blessed ones. He kept us informed, and he was always the biggest advocate. Jim defined that term before it was coined. He always said West Texas was open to the best farmers and ranchers in the world, and he meant it. They don't make folks like Jim anymore, and the airwaves in Lubbock haven't been the same since he retired. But I have a feeling that when Jim stepped into heaven last Thursday, Dan Seal was standing there at the gate and said, "What in the world took you so long, big boy?" And the dean of all broadcasters was home, and he was well. Jim, thank you for everything. Rest in peace, my friend. I would ask everyone to keep his wife Doris and his family in your prayers. You know, I tell you, folks, it was quite a blessing to get to know Jim and to be part of that radio show. He asked me to bring one of my girls in, and I did, and he wanted me to bring the other one in. I didn't get to, but Kylie talked about it the other day, how sweet Jim was and how welcoming he was. She said, "I understand now why you like doing radio." And he also invited me and my dad up there one time, and my dad was not a big talker, at least on the radio. Dad was definitely a talker, but I don't know what it was that day, but he was less at the talk. But Jim kind of brought him out of his shell, as Jim did with everybody. But again, it was a visit. Wasn't an interview. It was just a visit. So, I want to say, I know I played this song a lot, and I think every once in a while I'm still going to put it in the list to play. Just because, as big a Bob Wills fan as I am, this song has definitely taken on new meaning. I can't tell you, folks, again, how sad I was to get the news, but things like this will bring it back. But I want to play one more song real quick. If you'll bear with me, folks, we're going to run just a little bit over time. We're good at that here. But there's a very special version of a song that I have a gut feeling today that is probably being played in Lubbock right now. At Jim's service, because I just know that was what he would have wanted. Jim loved Bob Wills. He just loved people. He loved going down to Gale. And let me dig this up real quick. I apologize. I thought I had it pulled up, and as usual, leave it to live radio to blow things out of the water here. But let me find it. Here it is. This is one of my favorite versions. I'm going to play just a little bit of this, and then I'll come back, and we'll kind of wrap up the day. Hang tight, folks.
When I look at the letter that you wrote to me hit you that I am thinking of. As I read the lines that to me were so sweet, I remember our faded love. I miss you, darling, more and more every day, as heaven would miss the stars above.
A little memorial for my friend Jim this morning, folks. He will definitely be missed. I appreciate you guys tuning in as always. I appreciate you spending part of your day with me and allowing me to honor a good friend and a Texas legend, my good friend Jim Stewart, as we wrap up today. As always, I say a special thank you to my mom, my dad, and the original number 11 for tuning in as well. Folks, have a great day. Have a good week. Be safe out there, and in the words of my good friend Jim, God bless.
We hope you enjoyed The Pack Show with Dan Jackson and sidekick Eric Horton. The Pack Show will be available for on demand and placed on the Town Talk Radio website. The Pack Show is a production of Town Talk Media, and the views and opinions expressed in today's show does not necessarily reflect Town Talk Media or Adventure Marketing.